responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll discuss the fiscal cliff's impact on public health with former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener. We'll also debunk myths about unions and the labor movement with author Bill Fletcher Jr. But first, we've been joined by AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skwierczynski. Witold, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Witold, AFGE participated in a nationwide protest this week to oppose any cuts to Social Security as part of the fiscal cliff negotiations, picketing outside Social Security offices across the country. Where did this initiative take you this week?
I was at the downtown Metro West building, Social Security building downtown. There's about, somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 employees who work here. And folks assembled here and at about 80 sites around the country, different places, field offices, program service centers, teleservice centers, to send a message to the public and to Congress that we're unhappy here in Social Security about the potential impact of sequestration on our agency. And we're also worried that Congress, in order to avoid sequestration, will negotiate an agreement that would adversely affect the not only the beneficiaries that we service, but the employees themselves when they're eligible for retirement or disability benefits.
80 sites around the country, Witold, that's impressive. As a speaker at one of these, what was your main message that you communicated to the protesters?
Well, my message was mainly, I kind of summarized the effect of budget cuts that we've had so far. You know, in the last two fiscal years, well, this is the third fiscal year in a row, the agency has received a billion or more less than the president's request with regards to the budget. We're in a continuing resolution now, so we're at the same level as fiscal 12, and that has resulted in all kinds of adverse impacts on our ability to service the public. There have been 41 office closings. There have been 300 contact station closings. There's been a reduction in the hours that were open to the public. There's been a hiring freeze. There's been a elimination of overtime. We've lost 7,000 staff in the last 2 years and expect to lose 2,000 more in FY13. So that has resulted in a deterioration of service to the public. You know, our processing time has increased with regards to disability cases. Our backlogs have skyrocketed. We now have longer waits in our field offices, less calls are answered. And so that's the current reality. If we get a 5.5% cut, which would happen as of January 2nd, if Congress doesn't do anything in December about sequestration, then we'd be seeing even more adverse effects. The commissioner has testified on the Hill that he'd have to lay off RIF about 1,000 employees, and it appears that furloughs the remaining employees could be as long as 26 days. We'd have a $700 million cut in our budget, and if you have 26 days of furloughs, we're talking a day a week that the Social Security office, a day every 2 weeks rather, the Social Security office is closed, or maybe a half a day a week. And the employees are going to have to jam all their work in the remaining time. And the people who don't service the public, who are processing claims in our processing facilities, they'll also be laid off or furloughed for a period of time. So it'll create backlogs throughout all our work. And the bottom line here is if there is government that exists and that the public wants, and I think it's generally accepted that Social Security is the type of government that the public wants, that it should be efficient, that people who pay taxes have a right to get good service, and that the employees have a right to have adequate compensation. And in this case, this sequestration would fail that in all respects. People would get a lousy service. The employees would get a 10% pay cut. And Social Security in particular has had no responsibility for the budget deficit. Social Security is funded through the trust funds. It hasn't increased. In fact, not only has it not increased the deficit, Social Security is running a surplus and is still running a surplus. If you count the interest on the money that's been borrowed by the government, we're still running a surplus. And we expect to be solvent through the next 21 years, according to the trustees. So we're not the problem. So why Congress would have us on the chopping block is really a question.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Witold Skwierczynski, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, this sounds like a real lose-lose for the public and the employees of SSA if come January 1st there's no deal.
Yeah, it is a lose-lose, and the benefit either for SSI or Social Security won't be affected by sequestration. But if Congress manages to avoid sequestration by passing some kind of budget deficit legislation in December, our fear is that they're going to go after Social Security benefits. From what we're hearing on the Republican side, House Speaker Boehner, as of yesterday, is still talking about his inability to accept tax increases, a resumption of elimination of the tax cut for the wealthy 2%. And President Obama has insisted that that be part of any deal. We're fearful that Social Security will be on the chopping block, and the kind of things we're hearing are increases in the retirement age for both Social Security and Medicare, increases or decreases in the cost of living formula. They have what they call a chain CPI, which, for example, next year Social Security beneficiaries will get a 1.7% increase, cost of living increase, which is rather minuscule. The chain CPI would only be 1.3%. Now, after 20 years, somebody who's retiring this year, after 20 years, they'd be getting $1,000 less a year under this chain CPI. So our employees interview on a daily basis people on the margin, people who are barely getting by, millions of people who are barely getting by. We have our average benefit is $1,250 a month. Our average comes out in a year to about between $14,000 and $15,000 a year. Folks, 30% of those people, that's their only income. Now, envision trying to live on $15,000 a year. People who are aged and disabled have different have expenses in certain areas that exceed the rest of the public, medical expenses, and that's not even considered when the cost of living formulas are developed. So if you mess with that, you're going to hurt people. If you mess with the retirement age, we see people who are struggling to get in to make it to 62 to file for early retirement. If you raise the retirement age, the percentage of cut for somebody at 62 will be greater, so that they'll be getting less per month. And they'll have more struggles to survive. And all that's about avoiding tax cuts for the rich. It's insane as far as we're concerned. So that's the second message that we sent out Wednesday. If you're going to cut a deal and deal with the budget deficit, lay off Social Security, lay off Medicare, and lay off Medicaid. These are essential programs for the middle class and the poor, and they shouldn't suffer because we're reluctant to add a little taxes to the wealthy.
Witold, as you mentioned at the top, you've had 80 sites around the country focused on this issue, certainly an impressive number. Outside of that, what else is AFGE doing to combat this issue?
Well, we AFGE has launched a national campaign to contact our congressmen and to participate in rallies and events by coalition partners. So we're asking our employees, not only in Social Security but in other agencies, to call Congress, to write letters, and to schedule meetings back at home with their congressional delegation in order to express our concerns about both sequestration and cuts to avoid sequestration that will affect social programs and entitlement programs. So we're trying to there's a lot of other events going on. I know the AFL-CIO with some other coalition partners are doing a candlelight ceremonies at various locations on Monday. AFG is going to participate in a lot of those. And there's a series of events that we're trying to do to impress upon Congress that there's a lot of people out there that are upset when they're looking at the media, reading the newspapers, and seeing what's being discussed over in Washington that include measures that are going to adversely affect the middle class and the poor people because of reluctance of some people in Congress to eliminate tax cuts for the very wealthy.
Witold Skwierczynski, the president of AFGE's National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. Witold, always fun having you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss the fiscal cliff with former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bob Wiener, a former Clinton White House spokesman. Bob, welcome back to our program.
It's a pleasure, Jason, and thanks so much for having me. I'm here at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, where 7,500 researchers are feeling very threatened, both by recent budget cuts and now by sequestration. So to them, the fiscal cliff is very real.
Yeah, Bob, that's interesting. I'm wondering what the attendees down there are saying about all this activity in Washington.
Well, Jason, they're saying that cancer mortality has decreased 22.9% for men and 15.1% for women, about 20% in the last two decades and about 30% in the last three decades. And that's because of the research that would be cut some 8% additionally and has been cut in real terms about 20% over the last decade in terms of inflation. How stupid are we to cut off our noses despite our face in terms of the number two killer that faces all of us in the country? As you know, my wife is a breast cancer researcher. She has discovered a gene activated, Dr. Patricia Berg, she has discovered a gene activated in 80% of women with breast cancer, 70% of men with prostate cancer, is working on a suppressor and a blood test. And now, instead of 25% of people that apply for grants from NIH that get them, John Retzlaff, the head of research for the group here, the American Association of Cancer Research, says that only 12% of people get grants. And many people think it's way less than that. So there's a threat to the country because of the penny-wise, pound-foolish tax breaks for the rich and the two wars that are ongoing. President Obama has stated that it's a priority to do biomedical research. But the Tea Party in Congress threatens all of us.
Bob, what would happen to cancer research if no deal is struck? What happens January 1st?
there'd be immediately an 8% further cut in cancer research. And that's inane to my way of thinking. It is absolutely a stupid thing for the country to do. Now, I think what's going to happen, Jason, I'm more optimistic than some. I think that the Republicans have been forced to come in with a proposal, finally, and they did. But the proposal is Social Security cuts and Medicare cuts along the lines of Simpson-Bowles, but cuts nonetheless without tax breaks and new revenues. So they're putting the entire thing on the backs of seniors and the poor and the middle class. That isn't going to fly. But I think that what will happen is President Obama has put forth what's unacceptable to the Republicans, which is cutting tax breaks for the rich. For some reason, even though 60% of Americans support it, it's a 2-to-1. It's about 60 to 35 or something that support the tax breaks for the rich, support cutting them back. But nonetheless, the Republicans are adamant about that. I think, you know, from my 6.5 years in the White House and 16 years on Capitol Hill with Congressman Conyers, Rangel, Pepper, and Koch, I think they'll split the difference on this one. I don't think that either side, Jason, will allow itself to be the Christmas Grinch and to have people have to pay $2,000 more taxes as we go into into Christmas. I think the week before Christmas, sometime between the 15th and 22nd, they will strike a deal. And what I think will happen is Pelosi and Schumer both have stated that they would be agreeable to, instead of $250,000, either $500,000 or $1 million. And Boehner, I believe, will accept because he will unfortunately get the principle accepted of some cuts to these incredibly valuable programs, Social Security and Medicare. I think the Democrats will have to eat a little something and take slight cuts to those programs, and then they will kick the ball further down the road. But they will also agree to, I think, the principle that the debt ceiling should never be threatening the credit rating of the United States again. So I think it's going to be one of these. Nobody is happy, and Democrats and liberals will be especially unhappy. But I think that a deal will be struck along those lines.
Bob, with all of your experience on Capitol Hill and in the White House, tell the audience a little bit how you think a deal might get done. Will there be a lot of behind-the-scenes work that we might not know about? How's this process going to play out?
Well, we have precedent. I was with Congressman Claude Pepper. I was chief of staff of the House Aging Committee under the great, incredibly iconic, fantastic hero of my life, Claude Pepper, who, as you remember, we fought and got succeeded to abolish mandatory retirement, and we protected seniors from abuses in nursing homes and expanded home health care so that Part B would cover it more under Medicare, and we did all kinds of things. But one of the other things that happened was they struck the deal in 1983 to protect Social Security forever and ever, and it succeeded. And actually, the bottom line is, given the money that seniors pay in, it is protected until 2035 or something like that. And then even then, it's only got a 25% shortfall if the economy doesn't improve, which it will. I mean, we're going to get more jobs. We're coming back now. So, but what happened is the government spent the money. They didn't put a hard, you know, what Gore called a lockbox. Jokingly on Saturday Night Live, they made fun of it. It didn't happen as a lockbox, so the government has the right to use the money, but the law also says that the trust fund is owed to seniors. So you have two conflicting things going on. That will happen again, I think, Jason. I think what happened is the seniors, in fact, are owed the money by the United States, but we've spent the money. But I want to know, if you went to a bank and the bank said, we spent the money you invested on other things, if you would let the bank say, okay, then you don't have to pay me back. And the reality is, the good faith and credit of the United States still owes the seniors the money they paid in as premiums. But having said that, the media has succeeded in creating this myth that there is a shortfall in Social Security because the government spent the money on other purposes, even though if you add it up and you go to the Social Security website, it shows how there have already been 11 years since 1963 that they've spent negative years, and they've made up the difference in the trust fund. So the money is there in technical and legal terms, but the Republicans have succeeded in the myth of saying there's a Social Security shortfall. So given that, there will be a deal. The deal now will be to accept some of that myth, I think, and to cause either an increase in the COLAs, which is what Boehner has now proposed, or expanding the age again, so it's not just 65 to 67, but it's 68 or 70, which is a horrible thing for half of Americans who have real hard jobs and would be forced into working more years as painters, carpenters, road makers, and bricklayers, and so forth. Half of Americans have physical labor, real hard jobs, not just desk jobs, that which are hard enough. I had one of them, you know. So, that will happen, and there may be have to be a compromise where they expand the ages, or they expand the COLAs, or and Medicare likewise expanding the age was one of from 65 to 67 in terms of your eligibility for a lot of the benefits is one of the proposals of Boehner, and so that may be the deal that's in the making plus some expansion of some. Give on the rich tax breaks. Obama has already caved enormously because he didn't want to accept any of the Bush tax cuts because of the needed revenue. He wanted none of them. But in the last two budget deals, he accepted them. Now what he's done is he's got a quarter of the value, you know, the $1 trillion that the rich tax breaks are worth, and that's what's on the table now. And maybe there'll be a cave, and half of that will be accepted by the president as so it'll be a $500 trillion value to the Treasury instead of the full trillion. That I think will be where the deal comes. But Jason, I cannot see. I absolutely cannot see, and I don't think it will happen because there's a different mood. The Republicans recognize that President Obama actually won the election. There will not be where they allow themselves to get blamed for just fighting for tax breaks for the rich, which the polls are so clear, 2-1, that the American people don't want, I can't see them allowing that to go through Christmas. So I think there'll be a deal by Christmas. They'll be in the back rooms. They'll hammer it out. It'll be half on the tax breaks and half on the entitlement cuts. The thing that will be off the table that I think is tragic is what Jim Clyburn, the number two Democratic leader in the House, called war funding. He said if you included war funding, then you would have 300 to 400 votes for a deal. But they will not do it. What Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex is incredibly dominant, and the Lockheeds, the Boeings, and unbelievably the Halliburtons, who've been debarred, but through different names, they still have contracts, they have so much political power through campaign contributions that they will continue to be revenue neutral in terms of the federal government not changing a dime, even though they cost, they give nothing back in terms of dollars. They only do what President Obama said is cost us the total of what the next 10 countries combined pay for military spending, and we're stuck with that because of the political power of the contractors. That I don't think is going to change no matter what we try to do about it.
Bob, as we close out here, I just want to get your sense for the Republican counteroffer. Of course, this week there's been a little back and forth between the two sides working towards a deal, of course. But were you surprised by the Republican counteroffer this week, or was it about what you expected?
It was more moderate than I expected. I didn't think they would only go to Simpson Bowles. I thought they would ask for more cuts. So that's what puts it as a reasonable proposal that unfortunately is one where you can now split the difference between what they've asked for and the tax break restorations that President Obama has asked for. And it now makes it mathematically possible to make a deal. It's the old style of split the difference, and you have a deal in Congress. So I was surprised that and many people were surprised that they only went to the Simpson Bowles formula. It makes Boehner look more reasonable, although I think what he's doing is horrible and inexcusable. There is no Social Security deficit. Medicare is now 10 years more solvent because of the president's health care bill, and they are exploiting those and establishing the principle that you can cut entitlements. Unfortunately, I don't think we can do anything about the fact that we're going to have to give a little bit on that for no good reason, because we're not touching war funding and there's no reason for all these tax breaks. But I think that's what's going to happen.
Bob Weiner, the former Clinton White House spokesman. Bob, always fun having you on the program. Thanks for shedding some additional light on this issue.
Thanks, Jason, so much for having me.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll debunk myths about unions and the labor movement with author Bill Fletcher, Jr.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bill Fletcher, Jr., the Executive Assistant to the National Vice President for Women's and Fair Practices at AFGE. Bill, welcome back to the program.
Always glad to be on the program, Jason.
Bill, you are also the author of a new book called They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, where you try to go ahead and take a look at some of these maybe stereotypes and myths about unions and the labor movement. Before we get into some of the specifics, give me an overview of the book and what prompted you to write it.
Well, there's a couple of things that actually prompted me to write it. Think of the book as ammunition that the reader can use to respond to the kinds of myths, broad brush criticisms, defamation that you might hear on something like Fox News. So that's one way to think about it. It's providing arguments. It's providing an analysis that will help the reader put together an explanation about unions and about unionism. The way it happened literally was that one day I was called by Beacon Press. I had been having discussions with them for a couple of years about writing a book, and we couldn't quite come to an agreement. But then in the aftermath of the demonstrations in Madison, Wisconsin, against the Governor Scott Walker's attacks on workers, the Beacon Press felt like there was a real need for a basic book on unions. So they asked me to write it, and I almost immediately said yes. And when I did, I was inspired by a story, something that actually happened to me, which I write about in the book. And that was that one day I was flying from San Jose to San Diego, and I was sitting next to this woman in her 30s, who was very friendly, very nice, and I was reading a book about global labor union solidarity. And she looked over and then said she would like to know what people were reading, and I explained to her. And she looked at me and then said, "What is a labor union?" So, Jason, I at first thought that she might have just been joking with me, but it was clear that she really did not know what a union was. So I began to explain it to her, and I just used some examples that I thought might resonate with her. And she was nodding her head, but she was nodding her head in that way that all of us are familiar with, where you know that that person has no idea what you're talking about. So this book, in many ways, is written for her. It's written almost like a discussion. It would be like, when I was writing it, I was thinking about it almost as if I was sitting down for coffee with her, and she was asking me questions like, "Bill, is it true that unions bankrupt us? Is it true that unions are always on strike? Is it true that unions are sexist or racist?" And so I tried writing in a way that I thought would make sense for her.
Bill, and as I went through the book, it became clear to me that you did this and built off of a career, a lifetime of experience in the labor movement.
Yes, and I appreciate you putting it that way. In drawing on this book, I've had these discussions with people, Jason, with some family members, with friends, with people I was trying to organize. And I thought about the various responses that I've given
or overheard when people have raised issues. And I felt that it was really important to explain to people, not give them pat answers, not present a Pollyannish view of unions, which I don't do, but to basically try to give people background so that they understand something. So, for example, when we discuss strikes, I explain what a strike is. I explain why workers do go on strikes. I talk about issues of power. I talk about the kinds of power that employers have that many people take for granted. It's things like that. I try to provide that kind of background so that someone says, oh, yeah, okay, I got it. Now it all comes together.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bill Fletcher, Jr., the Executive Assistant to the National Vice President for Women's and Fair Practices at AFGE, and also the author of his new book, They're Bankrupting Us, and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill, I want to go through some of the myths and have you explain a little bit about what you meant by each of them. And one that stood out to me initially was myth four. And that is public sector unions cause budget deficits, right? I think this is particularly important for our members at AFGE and everyone who serves in a public capacity.
Correct. Well, part of what I try to get at there is it begins with a very fundamental point, which is that unions don't control anybody's budget. Unions are an organization of workers. And they're an organization of workers fighting to ensure that their members and others are treated with dignity and respect. So in that sense, they bargain with whoever their employer is for appropriate compensation for the types of jobs that they do and for conditions that are safe in order to conduct work. None of that is about controlling a budget. Control of a state budget, a city budget, a federal budget exists with the political leaders who are elected. So the existence of a union does not in any way throw an organization or state or whatever into some sort of deficit. Now, what does create deficits and debt is a lot of what we're talking about these days in the larger media, which is the revenue shortfalls. In other words, when the revenue is not coming in, and certainly this is true during recessions and depressions, when the revenue is not coming in the way that it needs to, then you have a shortfall. And what happens all too frequently is that political leaders, out of absolute cowardice, would rather attack the workforce and try to gouge the workforce rather than deal with the more complicated issue of raising revenue, particularly from the people that have it, the rich. So instead of the focus being on raising revenue, all too many political opportunists focus on how can we cut our expenses, and we cut our expenses not by necessarily doing things more efficiently, but instead by reducing the compensation and the benefits that workers are receiving. Now, what a lot of the public doesn't fully appreciate about this is that this then creates a spiral downward. When you reduce the compensation, when you eliminate the benefits, when you make the working conditions less and less hospitable, well, one of the things that happens is that you lose a workforce. People start leaving. They become demoralized. The work becomes less effective. The other thing that happens is that it becomes less and less possible to follow through on the commitments of that particular agency. You know, for example, sanitation. You know, you keep cutting back, and the trash pickups decline. So part of what I'm trying to get at in the book is let's understand why these budgets go into deficit or debt. And that let's not go for the easy answers.
And I think this conversation is particularly relevant now in today's terms because of the almost battles that we're seeing, at least out in the open in the press, about creating jobs in the private sector versus creating jobs in the public sector. And you use the Postal Service as sort of an example to talk about providing goods and services to people either through the private sector or the public sector. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, one of the things that that I regularly think about when it comes to the Postal Service is really how cheap it is to send a letter. People complain about the price going up and up. But when you actually think that you can send a package, a letter, a package, from one side of this country to the other for a very specific rate that does not vary if you happen to be in rural Maine versus being in metropolitan New York. I mean, this is actually quite phenomenal. And what is often discussed when people talk about, for example, privatizing the Postal Service, what is not discussed, except in the dark of night, is that while it is true that a privatization of the Postal Service in some cases would reduce the cost of mail being delivered, it would only be the case that it would be reduced in major markets. So if you happen to be in a New York or a Boston or Chicago or San Francisco, your rates might go down. But if you're in Spokane, if you're in East St. Louis, Illinois, if you're in maybe even in El Paso, Texas, you wouldn't be able to count on that. And so this attack that the public sector is under, particularly when it comes down to the Postal Service, people miss what's really going on. And that's largely because those that are carrying out these attacks are charlatans, and they're not being honest about what's going on. And so the other part is something that is almost never discussed, which is that the public sector can simply not function like the private sector, that the public sector has a different rationale. It exists not to gain a profit, but it exists to serve the public. So, for example, if you have a public transportation service, you can't assume that it's going to make a lot of money because its mission is not that of making money. Its mission is to serve the public. Now, hopefully it does that in a cost-effective way, but in many cases it may not. But its objective is to serve the public. That is very different from a private company where the objective is very clearly to gain a big profit.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our discussion with Bill Fletcher Jr., author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand
at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Bill Fletcher, Jr., the Executive Assistant to AFGE's National Vice President for Women and Fair Practices, and also the author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill, in the first segment that we talked, we hit a lot on the public sector discussion versus private sector discussion. One of the things that I wanted to get from you is this now trend in union membership between public sector unions and private sector unions. We're seeing an increase on the public side, but a decrease on the private side. Can you explain that a little bit?
It is much more difficult to organize a union in the private sector than in the public sector, because in the private sector, governed by the National Labor Relations Act, the act, in fact, is so weak so as to almost encourage employers to break the law. And so this is very, very unsettling. The penalties for an employer breaking the law are actually quite minimal. And so what you have in this country, time and again, is a situation where an employer will fire a worker for organizing a union. Then they keep that worker out of work for literally a few years. And then if the firing is overturned by the National Labor Relations Act, the penalty is simply to reinstate the worker at full back pay and benefits, which may sound really good, except for one thing. The worker has to demonstrate, A, that they tried to get work while they were out, and if they achieved that and received a compensation, then all they are eligible for is the difference between what they would have made had they not been fired and what they made. Well, what in effect that means is that, let's say for the sake of argument, Jason, that you were fired for organizing a union. You're out of work for a month, and then you get a job. And let's say that the job pays more than you were making before. You would be owed nothing by the employer who fired you, except for the month that you were not making anything. So the penalties are really just far too weak. And instead of the kinds of penalties that you'd find in any other case, it's just simply making someone whole, as they say. In the public sector, in part because it is a public sector, there is usually less resistance to union organizing, except, and this is a very important qualification, in those states, largely in the South and the Southwest, where public sector collective bargaining is prohibited by law. And in those situations, it's much harder for unions in the public sector to get started and to fully function.
This seems to go in very well with myth 19 in your book, which is, if unions are so good, why aren't they growing? Do you think that what you just said here has something to do with this myth number 19?
Oh, absolutely. Because when you look at opinion polls, I believe that it's more than half of the workers that are currently without a union would like to be in a union or an employee association. So there's an absolute desire on the part of quite literally millions of workers to be in unions. What they all have to decide, however, in each case is, are they ready for what they perceive to be the possible consequences? And that's one of the reasons that when unions are organizing unorganized workers, it's really important to build a strong organization among the workers to give the workers the right kind of support, backup, so that they feel like they can pursue what is, in fact, their basic right.
What would be an example of some of that support or backup that a worker could lean upon?
Well, one of the things that most good organizers do when they go into a situation, either when they've been invited in by workers or they are going in to explore the possibilities of building a union, is that they build what's called an organizing committee. And an organizing committee is a committee of workers from that workplace who are interested in building a union, and they are the ones that are developing, along with the organizer, the strategy for organizing those workers. And part of what that involves is figuring out when to go public, how to go public, if someone comes under attack, how to give them backup. The backup might be as simple as if a worker is intimidated, let's say, by a foreman, it might be as simple as someone calling that worker and saying, you know, look, Jason, we're with you. You know, it might be backup in the sense of getting legal backup in order to fight in cases of harassment or potential termination. But the idea is that you're not doing it by yourself. You're not operating by yourself. You're operating as part of a team.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bill Fletcher, Jr., the author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill, one of these myths that particularly stood out to me, and I'm interested in your response to, given, as we established earlier, your almost lifetime of experience in the labor movement, is this myth that unions were good once, but we don't need them any longer. Put that into a historical context for us.
Well, it's actually one of the favorite ones for me. You hear it hear it quite frequently, and particularly from people who claim that they're not opposed to unions, really. But, you know, as they say, well, you know, in the 1930s, maybe we needed it. All right, so let's go back. The basic reason for a union is that in every workplace, there's a power imbalance between the employer and the workers. And this is true whether the employer is, you know, Mr. or Ms. Nice Guy, or whether they're an evil Scrooge. There's a power imbalance. Case in point, the employer can fire the worker. The worker cannot fire the employer. The worker cannot vote out the employer. The employer can change the worker's shift. In a non-union situation, the employer can change the worker's pay. The employer may give benefits, and they may not. And they may give benefits under certain conditions and not others. So there's a basic power imbalance. Every worker that comes into a workplace finds themselves in a competitive situation with regard to other workers. And that's why you need unions, because you want to stop workers from competing against one another. And by competing, I mean everything from, in a non-union setting, a worker saying, I will work longer hours than you, or I'm willing to take a lower pay rate than you, just so they can survive, just so that they can be guaranteed to have the job. The union takes that out, takes the competition out, and says that the workers will be treated equally, and they'll be treated fairly. This is the fundamental thing. So when someone says unions were needed once, what they're often talking about is the horrendous conditions that you would find, let's say, in sweatshops back in the early part of the 20th century, you know, where workers were working under incredibly unhealthy conditions and very bad pay, or the very famous Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York in the early part, first decade of the 1900s. Well, that's true. That existed then, and a lot of that disappeared because of unions, because the organization of unions, and along with the demand for social legislation, made that less and less possible. Well, I have to be honest. In the last 30 years, as unions have been weakened through attacks on them, and as we've had changes in government, particularly beginning with the Reagan era, where there's been an emphasis on removing regulations, you have the reemergence of horrendous working conditions, including sweatshops. there was a case not very long ago in the West Coast where a factory was discovered in the garage of an individual, and the people working in there were slaves. They were from Thailand, and they'd been brought over, and they were basically slaves. So you have situations like that, but you have less egregious situations as well, Jason. You have just simple situations where there's something that we take for granted. We actually don't even think about it. But when the worker walks into a workplace, they lose their basic rights. They lose the right to freedom of speech, because if they say the wrong thing, they'll be out. They lose their right of freedom of assembly, because if they work with other workers to start talking about their grievances, they might get fired, even though technically they can't. They lose there's no freedom of the press. If they circulate something, they can be terminated. I mean, very basic things which we would not accept on the outside world, millions and millions of workers every day accept them in a workplace. So I would argue that unions are needed today more than ever.
Bill, from a historical perspective, is this myth, is this feeling that unions were good once but we don't need them anymore, is this something that is new? I know we're talking about it now in 2012, but what was the feeling in 1950 or in 1925?
Well, in 1925, that was one of the worst periods for unions. Mm-hmm. But in the post-World War II period, no, you didn't hear it that much up until the 1980s. And accompanying the rise of Ronald Reagan and Reaganism, you really then started to hear more and more this view echoed, this idea that unions were good once, we just don't need them anymore.
Bill, as we close up here today, I'm wondering if you can give the audience your sense for the future of the labor movement and where you see things going down the road.
Well, we have two possibilities. One is what I call the version of the Incredible Shrinking Man. The Incredible Shrinking Man was a classic science fiction movie from the 1950s in which this man goes through this nuclear cloud and begins to shrink. And the movie, at the very end, he doesn't die. He just continues to shrink, and he gets down to the size of an atom and continues to shrink and realize that that is his fate forever. That is one possibility. Unions will continue to shrink. And, you know, they won't disappear entirely. You'll be able to go into some cities and, you know, you look up in the Yellow Pages or Google or something, and you might find one or two unions around. That's a possibility. The other possibility depends to a great extent on us. That is on the unions, union members, and union leaders. I think that there's a great chance that we can turn this around and build or rebuild unions as vehicles for economic justice, not just for the people who happen to be union members, but for the millions and millions of workers out there that every day feel like they're being stomped on. That's our future, organizing the unemployed, organizing the unorganized, really challenging power, taking on what the Occupy movement talked about last year. That could be our future. It's either the incredible shrinking union, or it is what a good friend of mine called the reformation of organized labor.
Bill Fletcher, Jr., the author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill, we certainly appreciate your time today and sharing this information with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Absolutely.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skwierczynski, former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener, and author Bill Fletcher, Jr. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees.